Hi, good evening, everyone. So today we have Professor Gurbachan Singh with us. He's a visiting professor at Ashoka University, India. And he is coming up with a book titled Macroeconomics and Asset Prices, Thinking Afresh on Policy. So, and also please welcome on Research with NJ episode. And we have this expert guest of ours. And of course, I've introduced you with before I introduced my next episode. It's a bit of lag, and that's okay. So, welcome, sir.
Thank you.
So, could you please explain in few words what the book is about and how did you start with the core idea of it?
Yeah. So, thank you. Thank you for having me. So, the book is due to what I have been seeing and what I have been teaching about macroeconomics and about asset prices. So there is a lot of macroeconomic instability, also asset price instability, banking failures, and these tend to be very costly. The extreme examples are East Asian financial crisis, global financial crisis, etc. But even apart from these, even on a more regular basis, the instability causes a lot of hardship to the less well-off and to the less well-informed. So it had always been bothering me about what could possibly be done about it in terms of policy. And since I am also teaching, so I know what the literature has been saying, and it was with some sense of frustration that I started thinking and working on this. The standard reasoning is that the central bank lacks in adequacy of policy tools. So they face a trade-off, and there is only that much that they can do, not anymore. And even this is about macroeconomic instability, which is about inflation, output, and in some countries exchange rate is what they would like to take care of, but they can't take care of many variables because of the paucity of policy tools. Now in this context, asset price instability gets left out. At the most, what we have is regulatory bodies which try to ensure good corporate governance, fair dealing in asset prices. So when you have SEC, Securities Exchange Commission in the US, or SEBI, Securities Exchange Board of India in India, these bodies ensure fair trading, try to ensure fair trading, but it's not about stability of asset prices. So what I wanted to do was to look at policy afresh to see if we could maintain macroeconomic stability alongside asset price stability. So that's what the whole book is about.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for walking us through this brief introduction, basically. So, I mean, I have had a chance to look at one of your presentation material, right? And I attended that presentation also, and there were some questions. And so before we come to that part and talk about the book in a more detailed manner, I just want to start with the recession and the boom chapter, I guess, in your book. So, I mean, generally, the idea is like people don't care about boom. They seem that everything is going okay. Everything is going fine because it's above the trend line and they are so happy about things. They think that there is a lot of development. But I do believe that not everything is going good, is happy, happy, right? But what about the, I mean, like everyone wants to talk about the recession and the depression part of it, but nobody wants to talk about the boom. So, but this book specifically has been studied in aspects of boom. So could you please tell more on this one?
Yeah. So by the way, it is an important part, but it's only one of the many
parts, yes.
Many parts of the book. But since you asked, let me say this. So the usual policy mindset is about dealing with the recession, not with the boom, because boom is something that's considered good. It is indeed good, and up to a point it can be good, but when it goes beyond a point and for very long, then there can be unhealthy things coming in. It need not be fraud, it need not be malpractices, misgovernance, etc. It is just that the level of economic activity, the level of real investment, the asset price boom, the growth of bank credit can go up to levels which are unhealthy. Let me get a little more specific. For example, if real investment, that is capital formation, you build up factories, you have startups for that matter. So all this activity can go to a very high level. Now, when you are creating capacity with all this, there has to be adequate demand so that the output from that newly created capacity can be used. When the boom comes to an end, and these booms do come to an end, then you find that there is inadequate demand. Now, that inadequate demand should not be looked at in the standard Keynesian fashion, which is to say that, you know, the animal spirits are low or something has gone wrong, which is why the inadequacy of demand. That inadequacy of demand is endogenous. It is a consequence of the excess capacity creation during the boom phase. So from this angle, some of the recessions, or for that matter, the severity of some recessions, can be a direct result of the unhealthy boom that precedes it. So to take an example from India, we had a major boom in India from 2003 to 2008, and the rate of investment was very high. What that did was to create excess capacity. Subsequently, there was not much demand, and then there was hardly any rationale for real investment on a significant scale, on an adequate scale. And then followed the slowdown. So that slowdown in Indian economy, a similar thing happened in many other economies, that was a direct fallout of the boom that had preceded. So the policy implication here is that just as we deal with a recession, we also need to deal with the boom. It's like nipping it in the bud. So we will not have the extraordinary growth in the booms, but then we will not have the severe recessions or more frequent recessions. And overall, it can be a plus for the economy if we stabilize the economy during the boom itself.
All right. So basically, I mean, like, we need to monitor our policies during boom also, and we need to keep ourselves in check so that we do not just supply and we do not have demand, and then again, I mean, like, in the subsequent years, I mean, this will become a problem which will lead to downfall and maybe eventually go into a recession section of it. So I think this is a very important aspect, and then comes in with, I think, the macroeconomic stability part of it. And we have, I think, price stability given the full employment, and towards full employment given the price stability. So could you please walk us through this thing? I mean, like, because not many will relate to this thing, having the full employment, because are we assuming it, or we just think that there is full employment?
So before that, maybe let me talk about another very important
absolutely,
part of the
please.
Book, but related to what you were saying. So this is about the interest rate policy. So the central bank has a paucity of policy tools. It has one main policy tool, which is the interest rate. And it has two main objectives, at least in the context of a closed economy. Which is maintaining low and stable inflation and maintaining full employment. Now, full employment can mean different things, but we need not get into that discussion here. Excuse me. So the one important contribution from the book is to come up with an alternative interest rate policy which deals with this issue of paucity of policy tools. Now, here is where I make a major departure. Major departure not in terms of the economic principles, but major departure in terms of the policy making and the related institutional setup. So, just bear with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Please. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, everyone wants to know more about the book and what exactly you're proposing in this one.
Yeah. So, consider the use of an interest rate policy over an economic cycle. Using interest rate policy in a recession and using it in a boom. Assume for the moment that policy is symmetrically used in a recession and boom. Now, in a recession, when the central bank reduces the interest rate, what it is doing is, it is as if it is giving a subsidy to the borrowers. And it is as if it is imposing a tax on the interest incomes of the people whose incomes have been lowered. So there is an inbuilt and implicit and non-transparent tax subsidy policy, which is part of the central bank interest rate policy. Now, since it is not an explicit tax subsidy policy run by the Treasury or the Ministry of Finance, I call it the quasi-tax subsidy scheme, which is a part of the interest rate policy. Now, that immediately leads me to an important observation, which is that why not shift it from the central bank to the Treasury or the Ministry of Finance, which anyway deals with tax subsidies. So now at this stage it may look as if it is just a change of form or change of institution, but it is a lot more than that, because what it does is that the moment you shift it to the Treasury or the Ministry of Finance, then you are paving the way for the central bank to focus on the problem of inflation. And insofar as the recession and boom in the real economy is concerned, you are handing over that part to the Treasury or the Ministry of Finance. So what you have now is two different institutions dealing with two different problems, and it is also two different policy tools. There is one tool with the central bank, the other tool with the Treasury. The tool with the central bank now is money. Of course, it is not the interest rate, because that has been shifted to the Treasury. And the policy tool with the Treasury is the clear tax subsidy scheme, with which they can change the interest rate over an economic cycle so that it can stabilize the real economy. So with this, I am directly hitting at the very notion of the trade-off faced by policymakers. So what is being said out of the prevailing policy is that there are two objectives, one policy tool. Under my scheme of things, you have two objectives and two policy tools. And that's where you can make the policy more effective. But I haven't finished. There is a lot more to it.
Now, of course, this is a book. I mean, so it goes beyond our imaginations of this talk.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah, so I am not talking about various other aspects of the book, just related to the interest rate policy itself, and that is about asset price stability. So in dealing with the macroeconomy, when the central bank increases or decreases the interest rates, then it is in the process affecting asset prices. As we know, bond prices are inversely related to interest rates. But it is true not just of bond prices. In practice, even equity market, real estate market are affected by interest rate changes. And when the central bank causes large changes in interest rates, it is leading to large changes in asset prices. Now observe that asset price fluctuations here are a consequence of the central bank policy. So in this context, central bank is more of a problem rather than a solution. Now, when you speak to central bankers, they say that, well, if we have to choose between asset price stability and stability of output and inflation, then we would rather go in for macroeconomic stability rather than asset price stability. Fair enough. But what if you can have an alternative interest rate policy which can take care of both macroeconomic stability and asset price stability? Now, under the policy that I talked about, where you have money as a policy tool with the central bank and a clear tax subsidy scheme with the Treasury, then you are not only making policy more effective for macroeconomic stability, you are also not changing the interest rates in the market so that asset prices get affected. And because interest rates are being kept stable, therefore the asset prices also become stable.
All right. So basically, this is a little beyond my comprehension right now because I haven't had the opportunity to read the complete book. So I don't want to make assumptions and present my own thoughts onto this. But I guess we get a rough idea of the interest rate and how the inclusion of two aspects of the policies can be, thought in the one process. Right. So coming to the other aspect of macroeconomic stability that the book talks about, that is the zero lower bound. Right. And I think this is probably a major part of the book. Yeah. Right. So could you please elaborate on this one too?
So under the prevailing policy, there is a major problem for the central bank, which is that when they have a recession, then they lower the short term interest rate. But they can do so only till the point that the short term interest rate hits zero. You can't decrease the interest rate any further. Now, at that point, there is a dead end, but then they shift to what is called quantitative easing, and that is trying to decrease the long-term interest rate directly rather than decreasing the long-term interest rate through a decrease in the short-term interest rate. Excuse me. So, there is a way to deal with the zero lower bound under the prevailing policy. However, it is problematic. The solution is problematic. Why? Because in the process, a lot of money has to be issued. The central bank balance sheet expands considerably, and the interest rates have to be kept low for long, which keeps the asset prices high for long. And it also keeps the interest incomes low for long. So this is related to what I was talking about earlier, which is the side effect on financial markets from the macroeconomic policy. But what can we do then? So under the policy that I am proposing, since it is a clear tax subsidy scheme by the Treasury, what one can do is, instead of a quasi-subsidy, which is lowering of the interest rate for the borrowers from the central bank side, what can be done is that the Treasury gives a clear subsidy to the borrowers who are using the money for real investment, not for financial investment. So that's what makes it well targeted. It is for real investment only. Now, when you do that, then this whole idea of the zero lower bound, in a sense, becomes not such a stumbling block. Let me explain that a little more. So you can't reduce the interest rate below zero. However, if you were to give a subsidy on the interest cost, then you can always make the effective interest cost negative. Let me take an example. Suppose the interest rate is 3%. If you give a subsidy of 0.5 percentage point, then you make the effective interest rate 2.5%. If you give 1% subsidy, then you are making the effective interest rate 2%. If you give 3% subsidy, then you are making the effective interest rate 0. If you give 4% subsidy, then you are making the effective interest rate minus 1.
Yeah.
So you are dealing with the zero lower bound problem in that way. Now, immediately some people may feel uncomfortable that, well, I'm talking about giving a lot of subsidies. Well, that is not entirely true, because that subsidy is happening anyway. It is happening as an implicit, non-transparent, quasi-subsidy from the central bank, from the savers who are getting zero interest rate or negative, slightly negative interest rate. In any case, it could be negative real interest rate. So with the well-targeted interest rate policy that I'm talking about, this is not touching the savers. This is not touching the asset prices. It is touching only the real investment part. So it is well-targeted there. And it is, in fact, the size of the clear subsidy under the proposed scheme can be smaller, because it is well targeted. So, let me give one example to drive home this point. After the global financial crisis, when the interest rates were low, big investors like Warren Buffett, this is not to single him out, but since he's a familiar name, but many other investors, what they did was they borrowed huge amounts of money and invested the money in the stock market. This was not affecting real investment. It was affecting financial investment. So, translating it in terms of the subsidy scheme, since there is a quasi-subsidy to the borrowers, what it means is that the Fed was engineering a quasi-subsidy for Warren Buffett, and he benefited. That's where it is gets blunt. So, when we give a subsidy from the Treasury for the purpose of real investment only, then that subsidy is not available for borrowing and investing in the stock market. So here is the idea of a well-targeted and, in fact, a smaller sized subsidy during a recession.
I think, sir, similar thing happened during COVID. Not on a similar, not exactly similar, but somewhere about that latitude, basically. I mean, a lot of MNCs, they borrowed money as a loan, but on an interest rate. Whereas, I mean, I don't want to take the name because of one company in the whole of world did borrow money, but on a zero interest rate. So I think at this moment, they are the ones who are not firing their employees, whereas there is a mass firing happening around the world. Is this somewhere like because of the prevailing policy regime that is happening, or like because they had an investment with a zero interest rate, whereas everyone went in for a investment, but they had an interest rate, and now when the things are getting back together, that interest rate is not making them profits, whereas it's a bit of burden to them as a sort of a liability.
Yeah, so again, so I like to look at it as a subsidy policy.
Yeah.
So zero interest rate was not a market interest rate. Zero interest rate was a policy interest rate. So by policy, the interest rate has been kept low for borrowers. Another way of saying this is that the Fed policy was a policy of subsidy, a quasi-subsidy for borrowers. Borrowers would make a financial investment or a real investment. Now, by the way, taking it and relating it to the current situation, in the last 2 months or so, in the US, we've seen something resembling a banking crisis.
Yes.
We had the Silicon Valley Bank case, we have the First Republic, and there are some other banks too which have been seriously affected. But even apart from these few banks which have been seriously affected, a whole lot of banks have gone through trouble. Now, this is also related to this whole interest rate policy. So, in the last 1 year or 1.5 years that the Fed has been raising the interest rate sharply, it has led to a fall in bond prices. There are a lot of banks are holding these bonds, so they've incurred losses. And because of these losses, these banks have got into trouble. Now, some people are blaming the bank management for not being careful. Some people are blaming the regulators for not having been careful while all this was building up. There's an element of truth in both. But there's a third part of the story, and possibly a more important part of the story, which is the larger picture of interest rate policy. Because the Fed increased interest rates to a large extent suddenly, that is what led to the losses for the banks. So these bank failures can be attributed actually to the Fed policy, the interest rate policy. Now, all this would not have occurred under the proposed policy, because the proposed policy is about stabilizing the interest rate in the market over recession and boom. It is about changing the effective interest rate in the context of borrowing for the purpose of real investment only.
So that I think that is why, I mean, if I relate this to the companies who are firing, and the one company as of now is not firing. I think that is where their interest rate is zero, because they don't want to have their liabilities increased, right? Whereas they didn't figure it out on this aspect, and they went in for profitability because they thought, okay, we borrow money and then there will be interest rate and we'll have some sort of profitability and we'll then probably we'll be able to repay back. But things didn't work out that way. And I think this is because the Fed, central bank, didn't review their interest rate policy basically.
So the Fed had lowered the interest rates to deal with the slowdown and the recession.
Yes.
Then now it is increasing the interest rate to deal with the inflation.
Inflation.
So, you know, they are fighting one problem or the other. It is.
But they're not fighting it together.
And they're not fighting it long-term. And also, they're not fighting it with an eye on asset prices and on banking stability. Now, insofar as the companies which borrowed at low rates of interest, now they're... one has to be a little careful about what kind of interest rate borrowing is it. So it can be borrowing at a fixed rate of interest, it can be borrowing at a floating rate. Now, if it was long-term borrowing at a fixed rate of interest, then of course the present increase in interest rates doesn't hurt them, because they have borrowed long-term for a fixed rate of interest. However, if they have borrowed on a floating rate of interest, then the initial interest cost was low, but in subsequent years, when the interest rate goes up, then their interest cost goes up, and then they get hurt. So it depends on who took a loan, for how long, under what
circumstances.
But I believe home loans tend to be on a floating rate interest basis. At least that is the case in UK, if I remember correctly. US I think is more fixed interest rates, but then it's fixed long-term interest rates, which are viewed in the light of developments in the central bank policy. So the mortgage rates, the housing loan rates have gone up substantially in the US, and they are hurting
the commercial banks also.
The commercial banks, plus also the homeowners who had borrowed heavily. And they have to now.
And what about India? I mean, we haven't had the opportunity to talk about a bit of India. I mean, our banking system is also a little bit hurt with the COVID, and you know they've been trying to come back strongly. Yeah. They've tried to change repo rates significantly, but now that they've started CBDC as their pilot project, and they have been struggling again with what to increase and what to decrease, and how many time to increase and how many time to decrease on this part. So when that is where that is why I have been trying to do my own part of the research, where you know, like, what would happen if there were two repo rates, I mean one for the CBDC and one the other for the physical currency. This could have, you know, tried to avoid the runoff, the possibility of a runoff with a bank, right?
I'm not dealing
with... Yes, absolutely. I mean just illustrating on this the set part. So I mean, yeah, coming back to the book, I really want to. So this is the next part is very interesting, and because you know this is the outline of like a common currency area, something similar to the European Union.
Yes.
Right. So could you explain how have you proposed this idea, and like what exactly it means to have a common currency area?
Okay. So in the Eurozone, we have one central bank, European Central Bank, which issues one common currency, and it has one common interest rate policy for the entire Eurozone. Now, over time, people have seen the benefits of a common currency in the Eurozone, and they don't want to part with that common currency, given its advantages. But they do feel uncomfortable with the common interest rate policy. That common interest rate policy applies to Germany. It also applies to Greece or Portugal, which may not be doing as well as Germany. And that is where there is a bit of conflict that comes in. So ideally, they would like to have different interest rates in different countries of the Eurozone. But because of a common currency, they feel that, well, we have to live with a common interest rate policy if we have to have a common currency. That is the prevailing situation. Okay. Now, what I am saying is that under the proposed policy, we can have a common currency as we do have at present, but we could get rid of the common interest rate policy. Now, that might sound a bit strange. But
many will say outlandish. I'm quite sure of that. But that is not the answer to the problem that we are. Outlandish is not the answer to the problem that everyone in that economy is facing. The common man and everyone. But I think what you are about to tell right now, I will sense a little bit. Please go ahead. Please.
So recall what I said earlier, which was that the proposed interest rate policy is about a clear tax subsidy scheme by the Treasury instead of the quasi tax subsidy scheme by the central bank. Now, with that background, now I can move on to what can be the interest rate policy, or rather interest rate policies, for the different countries of the Eurozone. So under the proposed policy, the European Central Bank can continue to issue money and have a common currency for the entire Eurozone. But since we are talking about shifting to a clear tax subsidy scheme, specifically targeted at real investment, then what we can do is that the Treasury or the Ministry of Finance in each country can have a separate, explicit, clear tax subsidy scheme related to reducing the interest rate, effective interest rate, in a recession for that country. So that is what breaks the link between the central bank policy and the interest rate policy. By the way, let me say something which maybe I should have said earlier. Many people think that monetary policy and interest rate policy are synonyms. They are not synonyms. Monetary policy, in fact, way back in 1959, in his book, A Program for Monetary Stability, Milton Friedman had pointed out that central banking is primarily, if not exclusively, about money. It is not about interest rate. Interest rate is something can be left to the market. Of course, the market can get it wrong. But if it gets it wrong, then it can be corrected through a tax subsidy scheme. Now, this is applying the idea from Pigou. He had talked about it in the context of externalities in public economics. But that idea can be extended to a price like interest rate in macroeconomics and financial economics as well.
Okay, so I think, I mean, the core part of it with the common currency area chapter is that the economies should really consider having different interest rates with the same currency. So that it...
So here it's a bit more nuanced.
Okay.
The interest rate, there are two different interest rates. One is interest rate observed in the market. The other is the effective interest rate, which is post-subsidy or post-tax interest rate in the context of borrowing for the purpose of real investment. Now, what I'm saying is that the interest rate observed in the market, which is what is relevant for savers, which is what is relevant for financial investment, that can be common. So you have arbitrage.
Okay.
That can be common across the countries in the Eurozone.
Okay.
However, the post-tax or post-subsidy effective interest rate in each country of the Eurozone, that can be different.
It can be different.
Yes.
Would it be possible? I mean, like, I know the answer to this really stupid question, but just to, you know, like, have a futuristic dream about this thing, would it be possible to have a common currency somewhere in subcontinent?
Oh,
because everyone wants to follow rupee, but then everyone wants to fight. I'm not trying to ask a controversial question. It's just that, you know, like, because...
No, so...
Would it be possible? Because a lot of economies in subcontinent depend on India.
Yeah. So, from an economic point of view...
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
From an economic point of view, yes. From a political point of view, I don't know. That is a different...
No, because I'm not... I don't want to touch the political lateral because that's controversial.
Yeah.
And that is totally to the government. But from the economy point of view, from the point of economics, as an economist, would it be possible and, like, would it be fruitful for... Because in the subcontinent, what I have seen...
So just to clarify. So, the European Union, there's not European Union, the Eurozone... the Eurozone has done various things, and they have a common central bank, and they use the same currency. So if we do have a common central bank for the subcontinent, which includes various countries in the region, and fulfill some of these conditions, then it is indeed possible. Is it desirable? It seems so. But what I will add now is that with the proposed policy scheme, what we can do is to have a common currency for this Asian region without imposing a common interest rate policy for Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, Pakistan. So you can have the best of both worlds, which is a common currency but not a common interest rate policy. So depending on what the economic conditions are in different parts of the region, accordingly you can have a low interest rate or a high interest rate. Here I'm talking about the effective post-tax, post-subsidy interest rate in the context of borrowing for the purpose of raising investment. The interest rate observed in the market in the region would be...
could be common.
In fact, it would be common. That is.
So, would this allow, I mean, again, I am not touching the political aspect, the economics, because, and that is like, would it be possible for Sri Lanka in specific, because they are going through a massive economic crisis. So, would it be possible for them to recover in such a situation of having a common currency?
So, if they had had a common currency with the rest of the region, then the inflationary pressures that they have seen, so they would have gone through a bit of difficulty because of tourism,
absolutely, falling, yes,
because of the other things that happened to them. But in terms of inflation, that problem could have been avoided.
Avoided, yes. But then there are political aspects to it also, not just the economic aspect. So yes, so we won't go into that lateral. So I'll move on to this, the next chapter of the book, which is, I think the macroeconomics and asset prices, and mostly talks about the policy part of what you're proposing.
Yeah.
So please, I mean, if you can brief us about this thing.
Okay, so I'll touch on something that is related to what I was saying earlier, but maybe more specifically now. So in asset markets, we have the idea of interest rate risk. So there are various risks in the asset markets. One of them is the interest rate risk. So the interest rate risk in the asset market is that in case the interest rate were to change, then the asset prices would change accordingly. That is a risk faced by the investors. Now usually this interest rate risk is taken as exogenously given. Now here the emphasis is that this interest rate risk is mainly due to the changes in interest rate due to the central bank. So the interest rate risk faced by investors is due to the macroeconomic policy faced by followed by the central bank. So that risk is very high at present. But if you have the proposed policy scheme in which interest rates are stable, then the interest rate risk is minimized. And so asset prices would get more stable. I touched on a related part earlier, but this is more specifically about the interest rate.
Interest rate. So I think we have reached the completion of this book part, and let's have some sort of concluding remarks. I mean, like, because there is a lot in the book, and there is, and because we need to, you know, stick to the time frame of this episode. So, can we have some concluding remarks on this thing, please?
So firstly, it is not the completion of the book.
Absolutely, I mean, because this is a big book. This is a big book.
So, in conclusion, some things that I would like to say are that somebody might ask that do you have evidence that this works? Now we don't have evidence that this works. We cannot have evidence that this works because it is new. So that is not a good argument to make against the new set of ideas. But we do have empirical evidence that the prevailing policy has failed, and failed miserably. So with that empirical evidence, I am proposing this policy. And the set of ideas, what I'm saying is that economic theory supports these ideas, it suggests that these ideas can work. So that is the ground on which I am proposing this policy. So that is one part. Another part that I would like to say is that often people feel that there is a trade-off in policy. So if there is a trade-off anyway, then how can you even get rid of it? It is a given. Now, I think there is some confusion in people thinking in those lines. There are some trade-offs that are inevitable in economics. There are some that are not inevitable. Let me give an example of what is inevitable. The standard textbook example of guns and butter, or take any two commodities. If you have a production possibility frontier which shows you the possibilities for an economy, then there is only so much of the various goods that you can produce. So if you produce more of one, you have to produce less of the other, assuming that all the resources are getting utilized. So that trade-off is inevitable, it is inescapable. However, when it comes to the trade-off between inflation output, that is of not the same nature, because here it is not the scarcity of resources which is coming in the way, here it is the paucity of policy tools. Now, there is a paucity of policy tools under the prevailing policy regime, but we do not have the paucity of policy tools under the proposed policy regimes. So this trade-off is manageable. The other one is something that we have to live with. In fact, the very definition of economics in most places is about that trade-off given the scarcity of resources. But that should not imply the trade-off being inevitable when it comes to policy making.
So, I mean, keeping the economic aspects, I think there are political aspirations for the government and everything. So, hence, the proposed policy may be interesting to them, may not be. But of course, as economists, we need to propose ideas and theories. And
no, so there I will go back to John Maynard Keynes. And there is a wonderful set of lines from that book. Way back in 1936, he said that a lot of people talked about vested interests coming in the way, but he said that it is not the vested interests primarily, it is the mindset primarily which comes in the way of new ideas or things being done differently. So I'm not so pessimistic on that front actually, but yes, mindset is the problem. But even that, that would have been a lot more serious if we didn't have evidence against the prevailing policy. But we've seen time and again that the prevailing policy does miserably, which is the case for the proposed policy.
So how this book and the whole idea, the concept, would fit into the Indian economy? I mean, would if just in case, and like, you know, anyone from the government gets fascinated by these ideas and they think, okay, we can pilot a project and start implementing on it and let's see what are the initial results. So would this fit perfectly into the Indian economy and the policies?
Certainly, it is not for any particular economy. So by the way, at no stage in my arguments I said the central bank or the treasury of an advanced economy or a middle income economy.
Absolutely.
So it is general.
It is open, yes.
So that includes
India also.
That includes India as well. In fact, in some cases, India has been pioneering. I don't know if they will be pioneering in this matter.
Absolutely.
But one example that keeps coming to my mind, and I talk about it often in many places, is about what happened in 1947 when we became independent. The Indian leaders said that we will go for democracy, and many people in the rest of the world, and in fact many people within India, said that democracy is for an advanced economy. It is not for a poor developing economy.
Absolutely, yes.
But the Indian leaders said, no, we have to make a beginning and we'll get started. And in fact, barring some phase here there, it has been a success. So India was pioneering.
I think India would have not flourished had there would not been a democracy. I certainly believe that, because democracy has only made us stronger, better, and has only provided opportunities for growing. No matter the struggle that we had, fair share of struggles, but then yes, that is the... I feel this way. I mean, this is an absolutely personal opinion. Yeah, so
anyway,
I mean,
we can... that was just by way of...
Oh, yes.
Come back to the economic and to your question. Yes, it can be adopted.
Okay. On this note, we will finish this episode. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for arranging all this, for doing all this.
Thank you.
I appreciate this.
Thank you.